Hi, I'm Chloe McCulloch, Editorial Director for Building Magazine and Housing Today. And this is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast looking at the housing crisis, brick by brick. Your presenters for this series are two people well-placed to break down the issues around Britain's broken housing market. Peter Bill?
Yes, I'm Peter. I used to be important. But before I was important, I worked for 20 years in the building trade as a QS. Half of that time working for a house builder. I then moved on into journalism. Years ago, I edited Building Magazine, and slightly fewer years ago, I edited the Estates Gazette magazine. A bit later than that, writing a book called Planet Property, and a bit later than that, writing a book called Broken Homes, Solving Britain's Housing Crisis.
And Jackie Sadek.
Yes, I'm Jackie, and I've spent way over 40 years in the property development and urban regeneration industry. I started my career at the London Docklands Development Corporation. I've worked for private sector developers, I've worked in the public sector, both for local authorities and for government agencies, and I ended up as a government advisor. After coming out of government, I then co-wrote Broken Homes with the aforementioned Peter Bill.
Peter and Jackie will be pulling no punches, either with each other or with the high-profile guests they'll be talking to each week about how we provide the housing the country needs to thrive.
Actually, what we do need is a very radical rethink about how we provide housing in this country. And it's affecting everything we do. It's affecting our entire economy.
Houses are built by house builders to make money. And if they can't make any money, they stop building them like they did last year. So we thought it would be worthwhile exploring this issue. It seems to be terribly important to everybody, but there seems to be no answers.
So keep listening for the thoughts and ideas of key people from across the housing sector in this pivotal election year.
This is Home Truths,
a Building Talks podcast.
Well, good morning, Governor.
Good morning, Miss Sadek. It's a delight to be sat opposite you.
Well, as ever, what a joy. And we ought to really explain a little bit about what it is we're trying to achieve here.
Well, you're the fluent one. Off you go.
I mean, where to begin, really? You and I have known one another for decades. We are sometimes characterised as the odd couple, which I think is quite fair. We were having lunch in your club, you being very posh. And we were sitting at lunch, and I think wine had been taken, and we were wringing our hands about the housing crisis. And eventually, you threw down the gauntlet and said, well, if you feel that strongly about it, shouldn't we write something down? As a result of which, we came up with our book, Broken Homes, which, of course, was launched just in the middle of the pandemic. Great timing on our part, I have to say.
Our original idea, really, was to try and persuade people to build bigger houses and make them less dense. But that's, you might as well try and get them to believe in, fairies, frankly, because the social pressures on house builders, the economic pressures push everything the other way.
Well, there's one thing we're not doing, and that is we're not manufacturing any more land. And it's always the land economics that drive all of this. So I think we're beating our heads up against a brick wall on that one, aren't we, really?
I think the series is going to be about the things I like to grumble about, and the things Jackie knows more about than I know about, and how to get things done. But it's a very complicated subject to try and get your head round. Everybody has a view.
Peter and I will have some good-natured rows. One of our great topics to row about is car parking. We also row about modern methods of construction. We row about most things, don't we, Peter? We come at this slightly differently, but I think we are in violent agreement about the fact we just need to build more homes. And it's as simple as that. And what we really need to do in this podcast is to bring out from all different facets of the market and all different sides of the debate, how you ramp up supply. Never mind stimulating demand, how do you ramp up supply? And that's what we intend to investigate.
Well, it's not easy. It's not easy because 75% of supply is controlled by the private market and it goes up and down with the economy. So that's a hard one. I think what we are discovering already is that if you want to ramp up supply, you have to ramp up supply by the state and not by the private sector.
Delighted that our guest today is Peter Freeman. Obviously very famous in the property industry as being of Argent and having done King's Cross. And now, of course, chair of Homes England, has been in post for 2 years and has just accepted a term for another 2 years.
A fine man. We won't take it against him that he trained as a lawyer, but he's done a terrific job over the years in the property market. And it's just known by just about everybody, really.
The property industry cheered when he got in post, and we're very, very happy to have him today.
I think what I like about him, he's an idealist. I like idealists. I like people who want to change things for the better. And Peter has always been an idealist. There's an edge to idealism. It means, you know, if you're too idealistic, things don't get done. But he's an idealistic pragmatist as well. And he's obviously extremely intelligent and knows the property market backwards and has used that in order to get to the position of running Homes England.
Well, I agree with all of that. I think he genuinely cares and I think it shows. And I think we're lucky to have him in that job.
Jackie, I'm not sure whether you're a knife carrier or even know what a Swiss Army knife is, but this episode is going to be called The Swiss Army Knife for reasons that will become clear.
I love the Swiss Army knife thing, and as you say, it will become clear. I just want to say for the record that I've never owned a Swiss Army knife, and I don't really know what they're all about, other than the fact that I think when you're short of a corkscrew in a hotel room, they are a lifesaver.
This is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast.
Hi, Peter. Morning.
Morning.
Just first opening question, really, is tell us what Homes England is and what it does.
Nearly 2 years ago, I was asked that question by Michael Gove when he became the first Secretary of State of the Department of Levelling Up Homes and Communities. And I described how we give grants to local authorities to put in infrastructure to open up new housing sites, how we give grants to housing associations to build more affordable homes, how we make loans to SME builders who can't get loans from banks, how we give advice to combined mayoral authorities on regeneration in their areas, how we've been put in charge of some of the funds for remediating cladding. And we run the Help to Buy program, which is about 18 billion of second mortgages. So when I described this to Michael Gove, he said to me, "So you're my Swiss Army knife," which really rang a chord with me because my Swiss Army knife is one of my favourite tools because you can do almost anything with it. And in effect, Homes England is the agency the government uses to do almost anything in housing and regeneration. We're a rename of the Homes and Communities Agency. It became Homes England as a rename, but deep down we are also a regeneration agency. And the strategic plan, which was approved last year, makes it clear again that we're back in the business of regen.
Okay. What the criticism usually is, are you a bank or are you a builder? I mean, you're presumably a bank, really, aren't you? A sort of expert bank that people come to.
Well, we're unusual if we're a bank because a lot of the money we give is grant and we don't expect to get it back. In terms of the money we loan, we do actually get a very high proportion of it back. And within our mandate, there's a kind of tolerance if we didn't get 30% of it back. But the reality is we get about 98% of it back. Uh-huh. But the point is that we're a bank who's lending where we think other banks wouldn't come in. Okay. Whether it's because we're lending longer term, we do a lot of large infrastructure loans that can be 15 years long. There aren't banks who will lend against the infrastructure to create a new settlement with deferred back-end payment from plots that are sold in 10 years' time. So it's filling a gap where there's market failure.
But why would you lend to Barclay, for instance?
So that's a good question. And we lend to quite a lot of people with big balance sheet, like Canary Wharf, like British Land. And there was a good answer. In order to get big regeneration schemes through their boards, they have to demonstrate they're going to get a 15 to 20% IRR. And they can't do that if they have to fund the upfront infrastructure. If you don't fund the upfront infrastructure, you don't make a place, you don't let the buildings, and so on. So we're not actually really taking a risk, but we're filling a gap in market failure where ordinary bankers won't make 15-year loans that are deferred in repayment.
Back in the day when Theresa May was Prime Minister, she used to refer to the agency as the muscular agency of housing for the government. And I think we were all cheering about that description. We're in a very interesting moment in time, aren't we? We're in a transitional year. Whatever happens past, say, November, you know, it's going to be a change of government. How do you see the agency shaping up for the new administration?
at the core of the agency is its staff. And it has remarkably good staff. A lot of them are passionate about what they do. They could earn jobs in the private sector, earning at least 50%, perhaps double. Our chief executive left a private sector career where he was earning a multiple of what he earns now, but he went via Hyde Housing Association because he wanted to do good. And I think that permeates the agency. So we have a fantastic team. We'd like a bigger team if we were given a bigger budget. But at the end of the day, that sort of concept of we are the Swiss Army knife, if we are told to pivot by a new government to do other things, we can pivot. My own view is that in order to deliver the most, we need the most long-term policies, the most consistent policies. So hopefully, although we can turn on a sixpence, we won't be asked to.
In the same way as the private sector always asks for certainty, the agency would really like some certainty.
Yeah, it's partly certainty. It's partly sort of delegations, fundings, longer term for the money we spend. Because although if you look at our accounts, we look as if we have a 20 billion balance sheet, most of that is Help to Buy, which goes straight back to the Treasury as it's repaid. And most of the money we get comes in a sort of 2 or 3 or 5 year package with a very specific purpose. And one of the things that I think we've done very, very well recently is go to towns like Sheffield and sort of look at all our different packages, manage to get a few of them, and sort of 1 + 1 becomes 3, or 1 + 1 + 1 becomes 5, if you can bring them all together. But the more flexibility we had and the longer term the programmes were, the better.
But what's the difference between the last 5-year programme and the current 5-year programme, which is 23 to 28, I believe?
There's a different strategic plan, but the programmes are separate from the strategic plan. The programmes come over the fence, or the wall, as it's put, from the Department and the Treasury. We have worked on trying to create a policy delivery partnership so that increasingly we are involved in the creation of the programme rather than just receiving it as a mission to deliver. But there's still the issue that money tends to come in a relatively short-term package, and money doesn't sort of evolve. So if we get, when we give money under the Housing Infrastructure Fund to a local authority to put in a dual carriageway to open a site, if any money is recovered from the developer, it goes to the local authority. It doesn't come back to Homes England. And the more a government could give us the ability to kind of store up a balance sheet of our own, I think the more effective we could be.
Okay. I just ask you about SMEs.
Yeah.
You've got this programme on SMEs. Is that the government has always been desperate to lend money to SME house builders and have never really succeeded. And I wondered how your programme is either succeeding or not succeeding.
We're lending money to about 300 SMEs. Most of it is lent through joint programmes, where we put together a kind of equity partnership. We've got one with Barclays, one with Lloyds, one with Octopus, so that we can have operational leverage in the sense that they have teams who are banking teams in the market anyway. And we get financial leverage because if we put in $250 million, $750 million, there's a billion. Whereas if we just had our $250 million, it's only $250 million. And I think partly because of our own budgets and ability to recruit people, and partly because of the expertise of these brands in the market, I think it's a very effective way.
It sounds like you'd like to do more.
We have a number of more equity discussions underway. Yeah.
Do you recognise that there's a growing pressure to almost forget Help to Buy? Let's put that to one side. But there's a growing pressure to concentrate on the bottom end of affordable for social rental homes. And because that seems to be, this will come in through some of our other discussions, that this seems to be the only way to solve the crisis, if there is one, is a major programme involving the construction of homes that can be sold at social rent. And I wonder whether you have discussions at Homes England about whether the current mix of like 40%, some of it's 80%, some of it's 70%, some of it's 60%, you ought to be looking at it again and just saying, no, we want social housing. Social rent homes.
I think Thatcher was right, and actually Labour had begun the Right to Buy before Thatcher to sell and enable people to get equity. And I think it's transformed a lot of lives. What was a mistake is that an equal number of new social homes weren't built. Whenever people look back and say, but, you know, we used to produce 300,000 or 400,000 homes a year at that time, probably 40% of them council homes. If you really want to get the numbers up, you probably have to find a way of financing more social homes. But then that becomes a government priority along with all the other priorities of health and education. In my own view, more could be done in terms of land value capture to get land that is free allocated for social housing, and that would help.
It was a dilemma, wasn't it? It was a massive kind of dogma of Margaret Thatcher's that she wouldn't allow hypothecation of receipts on council housing in order to just put in more council housing. And I mean, I wonder whether you'd agree with our thesis, which is that the last time we didn't have a housing crisis was when the state intervened. Would you agree with that?
Statistically, you're probably right. Housing is a difficult thing because I think most governments since Thatcher, regardless of their party, have erred towards less government intervention and government intervention only when there's market failure. And I think there's a sort of a lack of recognition that housing and infrastructure are in some ways nearer health and education in terms of being something government has to intervene in and less something you can just leave to the market. Partly because it's a controlled planning system, so the government's in it anyway, but also it has such a huge social impact and economic impact where you put the housing, what type of housing, and how you supply the infrastructure to it.
So you'd return to the three pillars of social policy being education, health and housing, back in the days of Addison, say?
I probably would. And you could probably help me find a quote, which I haven't been able to quote, but fine. I'm told that Narayan Bevan, when he was both housing minister and health minister at the same time, said that if we don't build the right housing, the lack of housing will kill the healthcare system.
You do in your latest plan, and you keep talking about things like quality, and the latest one was quality, decency, good design and sustainability. Now, these are very foggy words. Is there anything you can say that makes you think you can make any difference whatsoever in the quality of the houses being built by house builders? And decency, what's decency?
I think decency is probably more about rented property after the little boy died from mold. I think the most moving day by far in my 3 years at Homes England was when we went up as a board to Blackpool, and we were shown some homes that had just been taken back under health and safety from landlords, where families with the young children had been living. You could see, because of the toys and the signs, the dirt, the squalor, the damp, the entrance down a side alleyway behind a nightclub. It was beyond grim. It was evil.
Well, it must have broken your heart.
The landlord, it did. The landlord had bought it without seeing it, appointed an agent to manage it, and in credit to the agent, phoned the public services saying, I don't think I can manage this. It's not right.
But when we talk about quality and good design, a couple of other very weaselly words, which the government seems to get in like as well, as long along with beauty. You have had design standards from you in the past. They've never seemed to me to be particularly stringent. I think I read there was talk of bringing out some more, or that you're looking at them. Is that the case?
So one thing about Homes England is, despite the name, we don't build any homes. So remember, and that's in a sense because we're there to intervene where there's market failure, and there's lots of people willing and able to build homes. So our ability to influence the design of a home comes in a number of softer and harder ways. The softer ways is we can publish standards like everybody else, RRBA or whatever. The harder way is in giving grants or loans. We can put conditions in, and then you get into the balance between are we there to produce the maximum number of homes, or are we there to produce a lower number of more beautiful, more sustainable homes?
More decent homes.
We walk that balance. We set up a committee under Sadie Morgan, who I'm sure you know, who is one of our non-executive directors, a fantastic architect in her own right, but also chair of the Infrastructure Commission's design panel. And we brought on six or seven people, which is the first time we did it. Although it's a subcommittee of the board, we brought on six or seven experts as well from different areas of design and management of homes and whatever. And the thing we probably succeeded in doing most successfully is actually enthusing the staff on design and sustainability. But we probably don't feel we have the teeth to force it too far by loans or grants, because it would cut the number of homes being built or the number of people, SMEs, we could serve.
It seems a pity, because you could just say space standards should be whatever it is plus 10%, like Boris did.
But again, that's a government policy decision. Yeah. We don't make legislation.
Okay. Just one last thing on that construction side, Peter. MMC.
Yeah.
Why are you getting involved, even at the slightest level, in MMC? It seems a very risky business.
So again, in a sense, market failure, because the investment market has not been particularly willing to support MMC factories. We have supported several. We've lost money on some of the investments. The reason we in the government support modern methods of construction is it is another way of diversifying the market of producing homes. It's a way of, it's a time when the workforce of bricklayers and carpenters is getting distinctly old. It's another way of bringing more people into the workforce. You know, more women are happy to work in an MMC factory than probably work on a building site. An MMC factory can go 24 hours a day. In some circumstances, the residents nearby would prefer MMC because it comes on site and it happens very quickly, so it shortens the period. There are different levels of MMC, and modular, which is the full, you know, bring it on in a couple of pods, bolt it together and have it done in a week, is the one that has been difficult for Legal & General, Barclay, lots of people. But the other sort of aspects of MMC that are more, you know, timber frames and pod bathrooms and whatever, I think are, if not going gangbusters, are definitely making a meaningful contribution.
Who takes the hit when they fall apart in 25 years' time? Because some of them will.
That's a very unfair question. Very unfair question.
I'm digging back into my tort exam 45 years ago. I don't think we would have been negligent, and I don't think we have a contractual liability, but I don't know.
There will be a scandal, won't there?
How do you know that?
because I was around in the 60s.
So almost all of modular is quite low rise at the moment. And if you actually go to some of the modular factories, I think you would think that they genuinely are being built better insulated to higher standards than some ordinary housing. So
I wouldn't
bet on your negative view.
Well said, Peter. And I would defend to the hilt your right to modernise the industry. We've got a million operatives retiring in the next couple of years. When these people are not coming back onto building sites, how are we going to build this stuff?
Hi, Chloe here again. You're listening to Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast. We'll be back to Jackie and Peter in a moment. But first, a reminder, you can gain access to all the content on building.co.uk or housingtoday.co.uk by going to our websites and clicking subscribe. Now, back to Jackie and Peter.
Can we ask you about targets, that fraught subject of targets? Peter does a great thing where he rails against it and says, why is the government setting targets? You know, you can say 300,000 a year, but the government holds no trowels. They've got no control over any of this, et cetera, et cetera. But having said that, when Theresa Villiers introduced her bill and housing supply numbers, you know, ONS targets were abandoned, all of a sudden a whole bunch of local authorities paused their local plans. What's your view on national edicts and targets and that sort of stuff? I think we've we have it.
There we have it. It goes back to the question of whether housing, like health and education, is something where the government has to take a strong hand, and it's a real balance, because devolution and localism are popular and they feel democratic and they feel right, but they may not produce as much housing as we need. And I think the early Cameron government, where they thought localism would produce more housing, was just a fantasy.
We wrote a report for Localis last year, which I think you saw, where we were advocating basically a wholesale return to council housing on the basis that what we were just discussing, that the last time we didn't have a housing crisis was when the state directly intervened. We came up with a model which turned the classic Section 106 agreement model on its head, i.e. we said, you've got a bit of land, local authority's got a bit of land, you want to work out how much social housing you want to put on that bit of land, and then work out how much private sector housing you're going to have to build in order to pay for that.
Yeah.
Is that a model that you think would fly within the agency? Is that the sort of innovative model that you'd like to see come forward?
Rolling back, and if I was trying to on high say what is the most important thing to change, in a way it's always about behaviour. It's about behaviour, incentives, and what. At the moment, planning is very difficult, and the sort of overriding view is probably binary. Either it will get planning or it won't get planning by putting a little more affordable or better playground or better porches on the houses or a little more landscape is probably not going to swing it on planning. If you could move towards a culture where the best, most imaginative, most generous scheme really got promoted up the lists, you'd suddenly have an incentive for the private sector to deliver the best scheme. And part of what you've just said about would you turn it on the head and do the council sort of kind of control the land and say, how much housing do I need? It's about land value capture. And I think that land value capture is too often thought of just as a kind of tax. And if it's a tax, even if it's a kind of goes into the local coffers, it may not be spent. It may not be spent anywhere near the people who live near that site are, because many districts are 20 miles long. If you had a kind of culture where the scheme had to be showing, and this is a tiny scheme, and then it's a roof tax of £20,000 or £50,000 a home, depending on the value of the land. If it's a significant scheme, if there was a culture that said, where's the benefit? We want it if there's benefit. If you could have CPRE saying, for every 9 schemes we oppose, we commit to support one scheme. So be that one scheme. Come to us with brilliant landscaping and ecology, not just 10% net diversity, biodiversity gain, but a brilliantly conceived scheme with public access and education. I think over 10 years, you'd change the system.
I wasn't going to ask about planning, but obviously, I can't resist it. You've got, week in and week out, Homes England is grappling with planning issues all over Britain. Do you seriously think, and you've been around a long time, and you've seen how Labour tried to fix it in 2004 and probably earlier than that. I mean, do you think this is something that is fixable in the sense that it would increase the number of homes being built if it was, quote, fixed?
Yes, it needs a lot more resource. It needs more planners with higher morale who are listened to more and who getting back to not we're in development control as our kind of fundamental mindset, but back we're building a better Britain. It's doable in the same mindset as you asking developers to win schemes with ideas and benefits.
What impact would it have on the numbers, do you think? I mean, this is quite an argument now, because we've got 60-70% of the numbers are controlled by the private sector. They go up and down. Against those tidal flows of house builders building and not building, the idea that planning can make that much of a difference against that seems to me to be pushing it a bit, doesn't it?
Take the number of tenures. You know, it's not just that more social rented. There's almost an unlimited demand for social rented. So if you can find it, you would clearly get many more taken up. But things like build to rent, which is now a fairly established sector, but it generates less land value than houses to sell. And to a big house builder who control most of the land, they're not long-term investors, so they wouldn't want to hold BTR, although maybe that's something over time they'd look at differently. So there won't be much BTR on their sites. If the planning system actually made more nuance about tenure, and in any major scheme, a part of it had to be build to rent, then that part would get built out quicker. And the placemaking would happen quicker, because instead of 50 homes being sold a year, you might get several hundred in the first couple of years and something's going.
No, fair point. Peter, you're always being harassed by government who don't quite believe that you're an efficient organisation and keep wanting to change you or bring you back in-house and things like that. And I see there's the latest report from an accountant at PwC is looking at your efficiency, equality and something else. How do you cope with these sorts of things?
The first thing I'd say is he's not any old accountant. He was head of consultancy at PwC. He's been the senior NED at the Department for Transport. I think he's on the board of Railtrack, and he has done a fantastic job. I think he has painted us warts and all, but I think overall he has supported what we do. He's absolutely clear that any government needs a Homes England, a Swiss Army knife for housing. And he thinks we're a pretty bloody good one, I think. Where he's made recommendations, I think they're very fair.
This is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast.
It behoves me, with my Innovation Corridor hat on, to talk to you about your extraordinary new job at Cambridge, where you are chair of the Cambridge Delivery Group. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It was an idea of Michael Gove's only last summer. And I think when he announced it in a room, there was a sort of intake of breath at the idea that a cathedral county, very listed town could take this growth. And the more he made the case for Cambridge, the more I think everybody in the room was wowed by both the possibility to do something fantastically right and the boost to the economy, because it is the European centre of life sciences. It's right up there on artificial intelligence, engineering, and all sorts of other innovation ideas. It has only one university, Harvard and World Bank, has more Nobel Prizes. If you count patents or unicorn tech companies, Cambridge is just way ahead of anything else in England. It also has a local leadership who are fantastic, cross-party, willing to support, have been supporting growth. It is growing quicker than almost anywhere else in the Southeast. I see my job, if I have a job there, is to be an interface between local government and central government, to make sure that central government does help upfront the infrastructure that's needed to make it a fantastic place to deliver the growth government would like to see, to not to disappoint people who are already there. In fact, there is quite a sort of deprived section of Cambridge, and we ought to lift that up. You know, it's not just to bring international bioscientists. It should be, if it goes well, the model over the next 15 or 20 years for what we could do to other towns.
Well, I talk to Cambridge stakeholders all the time, and I have to say, you are Mr. Popular with these guys, which is no mean feat with these people. So you've done terribly, terribly well. But, and there's always a but, the idea that Cambridge could absorb 250,000 homes seems to me like a bit of a stretch. Now, surely you're going to be dipping
The number has been reduced to 150.
Yeah, okay, I'm being provocative now. I did actually know that.
Officially 250. But
it's preposterous. You and I both know that you cannot put 150,000 homes into Cambridge unless you reach out to the likes of Harlow and Bedford and Milton Keynes to absorb some of the growth. Surely.
I don't think you have to go that far. I think within Cambridge, South Cambridgeshire, and maybe the edges of central Bedfordshire or North Essex. But I think, you know, in terms of sustainability, the nearer the better. But the science parks within Cambridge, which are the driver for it, you know, it's not asking Cambridge to take housing for the sake of housing. It's asking Cambridge to take housing to support scientific growth. And those science parks are spread over a very, very wide area from north to south and east to west. So I think it's reinforcing all the existing science parks with homes and more laboratories.
Well said. My innovation corridor people will be cheering, absolutely cheering. So, Peter, thank you. You've been very forthcoming. We're very grateful to you. And we're going to ask you our last question, which we're going to ask all of our guests. If you had a magic wand, what would be the one thing that you would wave your magic wand over to ramp up supply in housing? The one thing that you think would make a difference? And now I will just wave my wand for you and make it so.
My magic wand would be long-term, not short-term.
Good man.
It would be to get as far as possible a cross-party agenda that meant that whether it's the planners, the landowners, the people objecting to development, didn't think they could dip in and out, spin it out, know that there was a plan that was going to be delivered, that when we come back in 25 years, would be as proud as I am of King's Cross.
Well said. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you, Peter.
This is Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast.
Well, Jackie, that was a pretty interesting conversation that we had with Peter Freeman. Little guarded, but thoughtful, honest.
He does traverse a minefield, and I think actually he was a lot less guarded than I was expecting him to be. I thought actually he was very open and honest. And, you know, his love of the sector does come through loud and clear.
I think where I was less convinced really is on the getting in. They should not get into the weeds of how houses are built.
Oh, come on, Peter. It'd be quite a poor show if the government agency didn't try to get some ambition into the industry. I mean, you know, I thought he handled that pretty well, actually. And I have to say also, his riposte to you on modern methods of construction, I thought was admirable.
No. I don't know why they get involved in modern methods of construction. They've lost a bloody fortune on it, haven't they? Like everybody else.
Yeah, but Peter, we all know the industry's got to modernise, right? We might not have found the right techniques as yet, but we've got to modernise. I just haven't got the energy to fight with you about modern methods of construction anymore. All I will say to you is this. The fact of the matter is the industry needs to modernise, full stop. So shut up.
I'm shutting up now.
The other thing I just wanted to touch on was his handling of my question about targets, which actually I thought he handled very, very well indeed. And I just wondered what you thought about that, Pierre.
I think he hesitated for quite a long time before answering the question, which is always...
Yeah, we did get the deep sigh, didn't we? We got the deep sigh, deep which was very sigh. Telling, well, yeah.
He knows perfectly well the targets aren't achievable. The government know perfectly well the targets aren't achievable. Yet we seem to have them for reasons which escape me completely. I think the idea that you can have targets for housing when 60 to 80% of all homes are built by the private sector, and the numbers fluctuate down to the economy, is ridiculous. You know, you can't have a target where 70% of the target's outside your control. It just can't happen. Yet we seem to have them. I can see we might have them for planning purposes, but certainly not for construction purposes.
Yeah, and I think he gets all of that. And I think he understands that it's all about holding local authorities to account in order to have a five-year supply of housing and, you know, five-year land supply of housing. And targets for each local authority means that they have to have a local plan in place, which, of course, you know, recent political machinations have let them off the hook.
I think on that note, we can agree to agree.
We agree to agree on this one,
Pierre.
Yeah,
I think so.
Fantastic. Yeah. If you and I can bear to be in the same room again, bickering away like an old married couple, I'd like to see you again next week, sir.
Thank you and good night.
Thanks for listening to Home Truths, a Building Talks podcast. More from Jackie and Peter next Tuesday. And a final reminder that you can gain access to all of our content on building.co.uk or housingtoday.co.uk by going to the websites and clicking subscribe. Goodbye for now.